chapter 17. Now there was a man of the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Micah. He said to his mother, "The 1,100 pieces of silver which were taken from you, about which you uttered a curse in my hearing, behold, the silver is with me, I took it." And his mother said, "Blessed be my son by the Lord." He then returned the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother, and his mother said, "I wholly dedicate the silver from my hand to the Lord for my son to make a graven image and a molten image. Now therefore I will return them to you." So when he returned the silver to his mother took 200 pieces of silver and gave them to the silversmith, who made them into a graven image and a molten image, and they were in the house of Micah. And the man Micah had a shrine, and he made an ephod and household idols and consecrated one of his sons, that he might become his priest. In those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. Now there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite. He was staying there. Then the man departed from the city, from Bethlehem in Judah, to stay wherever he might find a place. And as he made his journey, he came to the hill country of Ephraim, to the house of Micah. Micah said to him, "Where do you come from?" And he said to him, "I am a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I am going to stay wherever I find a place." Micah then said to him, "Dwell with me, and be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10 pieces of silver a year, a suit of clothes, and your maintenance." So the Levite went in. The Levite agreed to live with the man, and the young man became to him like one of his sons. So Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, Now I know that the Lord will prosper me, seeing I have a Levite as priest."
Thank you, Judd. Good morning, everyone. It's good to see all of you here. We have a number of folks who are still away on vacation. We're thankful for those who have returned, and we're very thankful for those of you who are visiting with us today. We know that there are a lot of other things you could be doing this morning, other places you could be, and the fact that you have chosen to come here today to spend this time in worship of God and study of His Word says a great deal about your interest in spiritual things. And we're so thankful that you are here with us. We would encourage you to stick around for a little while afterwards that we might be able to meet you and know you a little more about you. Judd read a moment ago the 17th chapter of the book of Judges. Over the last year or so, I have from time to time been preaching from the book of Judges. And of course, as you might expect, we've been focusing our attention in those previous lessons on the more well-known characters in the book of Judges. We've talked about Samson and Jephthah and Deborah and Barak and Gideon and, you know, the major characters that we're more familiar with in the book of Judges. But when you get to chapter 17 in the book of Judges, things change. In fact, from chapter 17 on to the end of the book, these last five chapters contain information that is in many respects bizarre. There's really no chief character that comes out in any of these chapters. And the stories that are related in these chapters really don't have any direct connection to a lot of the stories that came before, the ones that we're more familiar with. And in order to understand what these last five chapters are about, we have to recognize that what we're looking at here can be considered appendices to the book of Judges. They're part of the original composition, of course, but the reason that the character, the tone of the book changes at this point is because the author is giving us a couple of appendices, actually, that describe the character of the people. They give us some clue as to the kind of things that were going on as far as the spiritual and moral integrity of the nation that explains a lot of the really crazy things that we read in the book of Judges. The first appendix can be described as chapter 17 and 18 for lack of time. We did not read chapter 18. You're welcome, Judd. And then chapters 19, 20, and 21 are the second appendix. These are two separate stories that don't really tie directly to each other. But when you read these five chapters, these two appendices, you come away with sort of a sick feeling in your stomach. I'm glad I didn't live in those kind of times. It must have been awful for the people that had to live through this. And I really think that's why this section is at the conclusion of the book of Judges. It does leave us with a bad taste in our mouth. It gives us a sense of how really bad things were during that period of time. And so the thing that I think really stands out, though, as we look at these closing five chapters in the book, is a phrase that is found early in chapter 17 and then the last verse of chapter 21, the last verse of the book. And it's the identical reading in both verses. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And that statement is not just a little throwaway line. It's really the key to understanding what these last five chapters are all about. Because you see, what the writer is doing, he is impressing upon our minds the fact that here's what society becomes when every man is doing what is right in his own eyes. When every man becomes his own God. Or to use our common vernacular today, when every man does his own thing. When everybody is more concerned about what they want rather than what God wants, here's what you get. If it sounds bad, if it looks bad, if it reads bad when you're reading the story, that's precisely the impression that the author wants to get across. Here's what happens when people turn their back on God. And so then, in order to help us understand something of this, we're going to today look at just the first appendix. That's chapters 17 and 18. We don't have time to look at the rest of the book, the second appendix. And then we're going to look at these characters, the story that intertwines them together, and then we'll take some time at the end to make some observations that have a direct bearing on our lives today. So let's get started by looking at the characters in this first appendix, chapter 17 and 18. The first character that we're introduced to is a gentleman by the name of Micah of the tribe of Ephraim. Now, this is not to be confused with the Micah whose name is attached to one of the books of the prophets later on in the Old Testament. That man lived centuries after this. Two different people we're talking about there. But this Micah was from the tribe of Ephraim. And we're given some indication of the character of this man. Look, if you will, at verse 2. He said to his mother, "The 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you and on which you put a curse, even saying it in my ears, here is the silver with me, I took it." Now, do you understand what Micah is saying here? Somebody stole your 1,100 shekels of silver, Mom. I confess. I'm the one that did it. So her own son has just stolen 1,100 shekels of silver. And, okay, is this 20 bucks in our money? No. Now, later on in this chapter, we'll notice that another individual was given an annual salary of 10 shekels. So if an annual wage is 10 shekels, how much is 1,100 shekels? We're talking about an enormous sum of money. And this young man stole it from his own mother? How would you like to have a son like that? Well, that's the kind of person that Micah was. But actually, the apple didn't fall far from the tree, as we'll see. Read on in this chapter and notice, when he had returned the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother, this is verse 3, his mother said, "I had wholly dedicated the silver from my hand to the Lord for my son to make a carved image and a molded image." Now, stop and make sure you catch what she said here. I had dedicated, wholly dedicated the silver. How much silver? 1,100 shekels of silver. I had wholly dedicated this in order to make a carved image and a molded image for the Lord. And then, skip down and look at verse 4. His mother took 200 shekels of silver and gave them to the silversmith, and he made it into a carved image and a molded image. Now you can read through this and miss what just happened there. She said, I wholly dedicated 1,100 shekels of silver to the Lord. So she takes 200 and gives it to the silversmith to make the molded images. Who gets the other 900 shekels? This is an Old Testament parallel to the story of Ananias and Sapphira in the New Testament. You know the couple that sold a plot of land and they said, all the proceeds of this money to the apostles. And Peter confronted them. Actually, they had only given a portion of the proceeds and said they gave all. They lied. And that's what this woman has done here. Her son Micah stole 1,100 shekels from her. She was stealing directly from the Lord. So, again, neither one of these characters stands out so far as being sterling representatives of character. They're both rather shady individuals, right? Especially when it comes to money. But I'm sure you've already noticed something else with regard to this couple, this mother and son. They're idolaters. You notice in verse 4 that this silversmith turned the 200 shekels of silver into a carved image and a molded image. And then in verse 5, so Micah had a shrine and made an ephod and household idols. So these people are worshiping idols in direct violation of what God said in the Ten Commandments. Remember the second commandment? You shall not make a graven image of anything in heaven above or on earth beneath. You shall not fall down and worship it. And yet that's precisely what these citizens of Ephraim, one of the tribes of Israel, is now doing with this hoard of silver that they have. So that brings us then to a second character that we want to look at that we're introduced to in beginning in verse 7 of chapter 17. He is identified as a Levite from Judah. Now, before we go further here, let's make sure we understand what we're talking about. The Levites were the priestly tribe of Israel. They were the tribe that was set apart by God at the beginning. And through Moses, the requirement was given that all priests shall come from the tribe of Levi. However, while all priests were Levites, not all Levites were priests. The actual priests came from the descendants of Aaron, the first high priest. All the other Levites, therefore, had lesser responsibilities. They still had a sacred role to play in teaching the law and guiding the people and helping and assisting in the services of the tabernacle and later the temple and so forth. But the Levites, in general, were not priests. Only the descendants of Aaron within the Levitical tribe served as priests. Now, it's important that you understand that. Because this individual, as we'll notice later, was not one of the descendants of Aaron. We're not told that here immediately, but that's an important thing to understand. Now, he's identified as coming from the tribe of Judah. And that, too, relates to the original instructions that God had given the people that the Levites were to be dispersed throughout the 12 tribes of Israel. They had towns and cities and villages that were apportioned to them. And apparently this Levite came originally from the tribe of Judah, Bethlehem to be more precise. But what we want to do is notice what happened in verse 8. This man departed from the city of Bethlehem in Judah to stay wherever he could find a place. Now, the record does not tell us what this man's motives were. Was he not receiving his allotment of the tithes that the Levites needed to survive on? And so he's having to go somewhere else for sustenance. Is he just tired of the scenery in Judah and wants to go somewhere else where it's more exciting? We just aren't told, so we can't read any more into the story than that. But it is interesting that he's just out looking. He's trying to find some place where he can live instead of where he's at. But notice what happens when he comes to the land of Ephraim and he encounters this Micah that we've already talked about. Notice that Micah in verse 10 gives this Levite an offer. He says, "Dwell with me and be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10 shekels of silver per year, a suit of clothes, and your sustenance." Now, do you understand what's going on here? This young man, this Levite, is not qualified to serve as a priest. He's not of the family of Aaron. He can assist the priests. He can do a lot of the Levitical tasks that is his right and privilege to perform. But he is not qualified to serve as a priest. And yet Micah says, "Be a father and a priest to me. I will exalt you." On whose authority? Well, mine. I'm Micah. That's good enough. "I will make you a priest. And I will honor you and respect you as a priest. And I'll do more than that. I will give you 10 shekels of silver per year, a suit of clothes, and your sustenance. You'll have free room and board and 10 pieces of silver." Life doesn't get any better than this. This Levite was looking for a place to go, a place to live. He found it. And so in these next few verses, we find that the Levite accepted the offer. The Levite went in. He became like one of his sons to him. But then notice, and this really is a fitting climax to the chapter, in verse 13, Micah said, "Now I know that the Lord will be good to me since I have a Levite as a priest." He hit the jackpot. He no longer has to depend on one of his sons to serve as a priest. Now he has a real, true, genuine, grade A Levite to serve as his priest. The fact that the law does not allow this Levite to serve as a priest, well, that's just details. We won't be bothered by that. I have a Levite in my house serving me as a priest. Life is good. Now, all this sounds kind of trivial, perhaps, but the story doesn't end there. As we go on into chapter 18, we're introduced to a third party. Actually, this is a set of characters. We'll describe them as a contingent from the tribe of Dan. Again, some background is necessary here. When the children of Israel first came into the land of Canaan, and the land, the territory, was divided up among the 12 tribes, each tribe was given a plot of land. The tribe of Dan was given the land between the tribe of Judah and the Mediterranean Sea. Judah to the east, the sea to the west. The problem was that the Philistines inhabited that portion of ground, and they were very powerful, very strong, and the men of Dan could not dislodge the Philistines. So they were very cramped. They needed space, somewhere to go. And that is what chapter 18 is all about. The men of Dan went out on an expedition to find a place where they could settle. Now, for sake of time, we're going to skip the first half of chapter 18, describe some details that are not really pertinent to our study here. But what we will notice is that they, along the way, as they were traveling to the north to find a place, they passed through the land of Ephraim, and as luck would have it, they encounter the home of Micah. And notice what happens in verse 17. The five men who had gone to spy out the land went up. These five men were from the tribe of Dan. And entering there, they took the carved image, the ephod, the household idols, and the molded image. All of these things that belonged to Micah. And the Levite, the priest, was objecting to what these men were doing. Look in the next verse. We'll go back. The priest stood at the entrance of the gate with the 600 men who were armed with weapons of war. And he asked them in verse 18, "What are you doing?" And now notice the response of these men in verse 19. They said to him, "Be quiet, put your hand over your mouth, and come with us. Be a father and a priest to us." And that's the same language that Micah used. Remember? "Is it better for you to be a priest to the household of one man, or that you be a priest to a tribe and a family in Israel?" So the priest's heart was glad, and he took the ephod, the household idols, and the carved image, and took his place among the people. He went with the Danites. So you see what this young man is doing? He's climbing a career ladder here. He leaves his home in Judah, and he's wandering. He's just a lost soul, doesn't know where he's going to go, how he's going to sustain himself. He comes across Micah. Micah gives him a deal he can't refuse. "Yeah, I'll take it. Good." And then these people from Dan come along, and they say, "We can better the offer. Now you'll be a priest, not just to one man and his family. You'll be a priest to an entire tribe in Israel." This man has finally achieved something in life. So, of course, he takes them up on the offer. But I think the thing that really stands out in this whole story is in verse 27. A summary of what has happened. This interaction between the men of Dan and Micah and this priest. "So they took the things Micah had made and the priest who had belonged to him." Tie that back with what we heard originally about Micah. What had he done with his mother's 1,100 shekels of silver? He took it. Why? Because he wanted it. And all that got sorted out in the end. What happens to this thief here? Other thieves take from him. Isn't that appropriate? There is no honor among thieves and with each other. You've got thieves stealing from thieves here. And it just gives us a sense of the nature, the character of what was going on here. But then we move on and notice that last line in verse 27, that the men of Dan went to Laish, to a people quiet and secure, and they struck them with the edge of the sword and burned the city with fire. They just march in, murder all these people, men, women, and children, take over their place, and that's going to be their new home. No regard to these people. The fact that the record tells us they were a people quiet and secure. They had nothing to fear. They were no threat to anybody else. But, in keeping with the spirit of the times, the men of Dan wanted their territory, and they took it. If it meant slaughtering the population, tough luck for them. So that's the character of the times that we're looking at. One more thing. Look in verse 30 of chapter 18. You know, all we're told at this point was that this was a Levite. We aren't told any more about him, except that he came from the area of Judah. But look at verse 30. "The children of Dan set up for themselves the carved image, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, and his sons were priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land." Now, if you're reading from the English Standard Version or the NIV or RSV, or there's several other versions, you'll notice it reads differently. He's described as Jonathan, son of Gershom, the son of Moses. In fact, if your Bible has footnotes and it has Manasseh in the text, look at the footnote, and it will likely have Moses there. There's some textual variations, and we won't go into all that detail. In fact, I would encourage you, if you've not already seen it, to pick up a copy of today's bulletin. The article today deals with this very detail in this story. But if, in fact, that alternate reading is correct, we're looking at the grandson of Moses, who was selling his soul to the devil, to the highest bidder. You don't see the same kind of fidelity to the Lord, to the will of the Lord, in this young man that you saw in his grandfather, Moses. This fellow was in it for the buck. And whoever could give him the better deal, the better offer, the law meant nothing. What the law said about his responsibilities and his duties was irrelevant. It's who pays better. That's all he was concerned about. And again, this gives us a hint as to how far the character of the people has sunk, that the grandson of Moses himself is engaged in this kind of chicanery. So then, that's the story. We could go on and look in chapters 19 through 21, which we will not do. And even though it's not directly related to this story, it gives us even some further backdrop as to what was going on during this period of time. So that raises the question then, why is this story in the Bible? And more importantly, why should we study it? What impact does it possibly have on us? And it sounds rather interesting, but it's so ancient, it's so weird. What does it mean to you and me today? I want to suggest for consideration quickly four lessons that we can draw from this story. When we look at the story of Micah and Jonathan the Levite and these men of the tribe of Dan, we see four things. First, we see what happens when people lose respect for God and His law. You probably noticed in some of the readings that we were doing here that the Lord's name comes up several times. People on more than one occasion refer to the Lord or honoring the Lord or making an idol to the Lord. But it's obvious that they're using the Lord's name in a purely token fashion. They have no respect for Him or His law. They disregard anything that God has said and they just do whatever they want to do. You know, it's not surprising. If you go back and look through this story again, you can find at least five of the Ten Commandments are violated in this short story. The making of the images of God, the young man dishonoring his mother, the stealing, the coveting, the murder. There are things going on in this story that indicate these people could care less what God wanted them to do, how He wanted them to live. Again, it goes back to that statement that was made at the outset that there was no king in Israel and every man did what was right in his own eyes. They didn't care what God wanted, what God said was right. The second thing that we can see here is what happens when people lose respect for the rights of others. Again, I hope it was very obvious that these people had no reservations whatsoever about taking whatever they wanted from others, including their lives. It was to their advantage to do so. It was just a horrible period of time in which to live. Consequently, there was no trust among these people. You didn't dare turn your back on anybody for fear of being stabbed in the back. And in fact, you could go so far as to say that pretty much these people were living under the law of the jungle. Whatever an individual could get away with, whatever he could impose on other people to his advantage, that's what people did. And it was just a horrible circumstance in which to live. But when people lose respect for the rights of others, those rights get trampled. And you can't trust anybody else. And here is a classic example of what society will end up being. A third thing, we see what happens when religious leaders are derelict in their duty. There was one person in this whole sorry story who was in a position to stand up and put a stop to this foolishness. It was the grandson of Moses, apparently. Now, shouldn't he have been qualified? Shouldn't he have had the presence of mind, the integrity of heart, to stand up to these people like his grandfather did and said, "No, this is wrong. You will not do this." But he didn't do it. He was a Levite. He's one who should have known the law, who should have been teaching the law. But he sold his soul to the devil and just went along with it, with everybody else. What was he interested in? Not God. Not God's law. He was concerned with number one. What's in it for me? Who pays the highest? That's what I'm interested in. And consequently, any kind of influence he could have had was used to instead of thwarting this kind of behavior, was actually feeding it, encouraging it, promoting it. There will always be, in every age, those who will gladly tell us what we want to hear. They'll tickle our ears. They'll tell us what we want to know, and not what God wants us to know. Those are not the kind of teachers that we need to surround ourselves with. And then finally, we see in this story what happens when society embraces a philosophy of absolute autonomy. By absolute autonomy, I mean a situation in which everybody does his own thing. There are no rules. There are no restrictions. There is no objective standard that everybody can point to and say, that is what is going to guide us as a people. All of that's out the window here. Again, it's every man doing what is right in his own eyes. And that philosophy of autonomy reached its full fruition in the next few chapters. I would encourage you to go home and read the last three chapters of the book of Judges. It's just a horrible story. It describes a state of moral depravity that falls in the same category with Sodom and Gomorrah. And this is the people of God now engaged in this kind of behavior. Someone has made the observation that when people turn their hearts and their minds away from God, there are many things that God could do to punish them, but there's one thing that's really the worst punishment of all. And Paul describes that in Romans chapter 1, describing the downfall of the Gentiles away from God. He describes them not thanking God, forgetting God, turning their backs on God. But notice three times in Romans 1, Paul says that God gave them up to uncleanness. He gave them up to vile passions. He gave them over to a debased mind. The worst thing that God can do to punish us when we determine that we're going to turn our backs on Him is He can let us do it. He can let us go. He can let us reap the fruit of the decision that we have made. And every time throughout history that people have gone in that direction in their lives, either individually or as a society, God, instead of standing in their way, He'll let them go. He'll give them over for that life that they have chosen. And they are going to have to eat the fruits of the decision that they have made. And it's always, always an ugly, bitter fruit that they have to eat. And that's what happened here on this occasion. The nation of Israel descended into a state of anarchy that very nearly destroyed them. And it all goes back to the fact that they were not willing to submit themselves to the law of God, but every man became a god unto himself. That brings us then to a concluding thought. The same problem that plagued Israel then plagues our society today. People have become their own god. They honor no law higher than themselves, and our society is paying a price for that, is it not? How many times do we look at the headlines in our newspapers, on television, and we think, how much lower can our society go? Folks, it's not the politicians' fault. They're not the ones that put us in this predicament. It was the fault of ordinary people back then, most of whose names we don't even know. And that's why these little stories are given here at the tail end of Judges, to help us in later generations to recognize that when we see that same kind of behavior, the same kind of social breakdown taking place, we can know it's not the leader's fault. It's our fault. It's we, the people. And our careless attitudes about God, about God's law, that have created the situation that we are in. Now there have been throughout history, and there is yet today, some who are the exception to this kind of behavior. They are the ones who are tired of this kind of life. And not just in pointing fingers at other people around them. They're tired of it in their own lives. They recognize the bad attitudes that they have had, the sorry decisions that they have made, the lack of wisdom and good judgment that has guided their lives in the past. They're tired of that. And they recognize there's got to be a better way. And these are the people who have found in Jesus Christ an alternative model for them to follow in their lives. Look at what Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 15. He, Jesus, died for all, that those who live should live no longer for themselves, but for Him who died for them and rose again. These people are not their own gods. These are not the people who have decided, no thanks God, I can figure this out on my own. They come to God and fall down on their knees begging God's help. And God has given that help in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. And knowing that He died for them, they now see an opportunity to live their lives no longer for themselves, but for Him who died for them and rose again. This can be personally enriching, but it's also going to have a profound impact on society as a whole. If you're here this morning and you recognize that you have been far too much in the same category with the people we've been reading about this morning. Your life has been dictated by what you want, by what you feel, by what benefits you personally. Open your eyes and recognize that's a dead end. It never ends well for anybody who takes that approach in life. Look to Jesus, the one who loved you and died for you, that you might live for Him. If you need to respond this morning, we encourage you to come forward and express your need as we stand and sing the invitation song.